You're listening to The Point, and we're discussing memoirs from individuals with ties to our region. Joining us now, Crocker Snow. Welcome.
Happy to be here.
All right, so where does the title Swamp Yankee come from? What does that mean?
Well, my father, it really came from him because he was somewhat of a Swamp Yankee himself once in a while. He used to joke about it, and because he was somewhat independent and stubborn, and I sort of am too.
It's interesting. Your father was a pilot. His first pilot license signed by Orville Wright?
You are correct.
You still have it?
I do in my living room. It's all of most of his papers went to Smithsonian Air and Space, but the one thing I caught was that particular license.
Yeah. So why did you want to write this? This is a memoir. Why did you want to write this?
Well, the real question is, most journalists do, and I've had quite a journalistic career going a lot of places, and I didn't want to do it. I thought that was a cliche. And bottom line, several friends kept, do it. I'm part of an alibi group of older men, and they said, come on, do it. And I said, no. And then my very favorite dog died, and I buried her, and just was motivated to sit down and write the introduction and the first two chapters and shared that with a couple of friends. Is this interesting or not? And I got kind of a, they didn't know each other, and I kind of got a B+, A+ from my grades, and I said, I guess it is interesting, so I pushed ahead.
Well, you certainly have led a very interesting life. Now, I'm going to go into some of that. Obviously, we can't get to everything, but people have to read the book to know everything that happened to you. But you had this really interesting childhood with this eclectic family of all kinds of experiences. So that sort of, I guess, inspired you for your lust for life and adventure, right?
I guess. I didn't know it at the time. It was just my life. My mother was a steeplechase rider. My father's a very well-known pilot. And my mother's brother was in the Iditarod in Alaska 9 times after he was 75.
Wow.
And so I was influenced by all of them, I guess.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to start with some of the highlights that I took from the book. You were at Harvard. And you got this letter of introduction signed by a Boston Globe editor so that you could go to the Soviet Union and Soviet authorities would let you travel in the country. And this was just like a little, like, couple of lines, right?
Right.
And you ended up with a 4-part series titled Student Adventures in Russia. I might add, it was on the editorial page.
That's correct. It happened to appear the day I came back from Europe. So suddenly I looked around. I'm a big guy.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that experience, because Russia was a different place at that time.
It was 1 year after Sputnik, so it was the first year or the first and a half year it was open to American tourists. And I don't know how I had this chutzpah to go to the Globe, because I'd worked as a copy boy the summer before at the Globe, and I just did. And I said, what do you think? And they said, if you get the visa, we'll support you, and gave me that very little letter. And I used that to get on with it. And it was exhausting because all the Russians, I was so fascinated to talk to young sort of teenagers, American. And I really got into it and found a lot of comparisons between Russian people and American people were very expensive. And I got along well with them pretty quickly. Not officialdom. I got in trouble, as you gathered, but
And let's talk about that trouble. You were pretty brazen there. You had your camera taken by Russian authorities after breaking this rule. They said no pictures at all as you neared the border into Finland and Helsinki. And you went, well, let me give it a shot.
Yeah.
And you took the pictures.
And we were in these old trains at the time with your own compartment. You know, and I was so naive, nobody's going to see me. And we're getting close to the border, chick, chick, chick. And then as I wrote, we were already into Finland when the train stopped. And then the Russian guys showed up and the Finnish guys showed up and stopped the train for probably 45 minutes or an hour. And I wasn't really know what the outcome was going to be. I wasn't scared. I was too naive to be scared. And today, to go even close to that in Russia, you may be
you'd be in big trouble. Right. Yeah. So but the most that they took your camera and said they would mail you your photographs, and you thought, that's it. I'm never going to see those again.
Exactly.
And in fact, when you came home, they did mail you the photos minus the ones at the border.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And so it wasn't all negative at all. And somehow I had the journalism in me, that seed in me. If you're not supposed to do this, then do it. There must be a reason.
And that wasn't the only time you did that, as a matter of fact. You mentioned that you were you started your career with the Boston Globe as, at 15, copy boy.
What, correct.
Because people are like, oh, copy boy. What's a copy boy? Basically, you're an errand runner, right?
Yes, exactly. And I had basically got hot pastrami's for the Suffolk. But I did have my first two columns then. Or not column, wrong. Published things. One was the feed fisher, and I had to go around to all the fish places and who's getting what fish. And I started writing that, and the sports editor was very supportive and said, do a little column about what you think about striped bass. So I put that along. And
that's pretty exciting for a 15-year-old.
Yeah,
right?
It was.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about your time in Japan, because you fell in love with Japan. Right?
I did indeed.
All right, so first in the Navy and then later as a journalist. Talk about your introduction to Japan.
That's a very good question, because my father was my initial feelings about Japan was very negative, because my father was a pilot. And that, as a youngster, I was getting all those associations. But then when I was in the Navy OCS, I was going to go to Norfolk. I did pretty well, and it was kind of a credibility then. And so I was going to go to Norfolk on a destroyer. And the night before my interview, a friend of mine said, why don't you go something you don't like? Why don't you go to Japan? And then one night I decided, and I was about to get married. My wife was in Radcliffe then, and I called her up and said, I think we're going to go to Japan. And that's how it happened. But my first, you asked my first reactions, was in Tokyo. We flew in. I trained for minesweeping. And for 2 days, we get out on a World War II torpedo boat in Tokyo Bay. I happen to know somebody who took me out before my mineswapper showed up. The mineswapper that I was on was very small, wooden, very rough, because they didn't want to explode magnetic mines. And the first night out from Tokyo Bay back to Kyushu, where we were based, we got in a small typhoon. Mm-hmm. And that was, I'd been in the sea a lot. I'd never been seasick. And the entire crew was seasick, and yeah. I wanted to die. Mm. And because I was in charge with two other officers and just hanging on. And the next day we got through the edge of that and got into the Sea of Japan, and the seas flatted down. And so that was my first reaction. In terms of the life of Japan, we were in a small port in southern Japan, Kyushu, called Sasebo, and it's where Pearl Harbor had been planned secretly. They didn't have enough at the time Navy housing for the officers, so my wife and I got a classically Japanese house with tatami and cold water and all that up in a small part of a mountain near the base. So my first reaction was that, and I just loved it right away. And the smell of tatami and the way life was, and sushi at the time was new to me and new to you at that point. But, you know, it was probably 12 cents. And I just fell in love with it. It was so different than the Western life that I was exposed to in the U.S. and Western Europe and even Japan. It was just completely, completely different.
Yeah. And then, of course, you also later on covered Japan as a journalist. And it was there that you came to the realization that a journalist must learn to see the world through the eyes of others, not just from an American perspective. That's such an important point.
Thank you. Yes, it didn't hit me like that. It hit me slowly, because I knew Japan pretty well when I was back there for the Boston Globe. I was their first correspondent in Asia. And I knew Japan pretty well, and I could speak Kyushu Ben, which is the southern. I couldn't read and write it. And then I was writing a lot from there. And then slowly I realized, even though I knew Japan well, I was still writing with Western eyes in a Western context about a non-Western world. And afterwards, when I get back to the Globe, then all of a sudden somebody approached me about the World Paper, and that's why that was my life's work. Mm-hmm. And I just step by step said there is a purpose for a more pluralistic view of global matters. And the only way to get there is not have me going to Japan or Germany, but getting a top German journalist, a Russian journalist, a Chinese or whatever, writing for a worldwide audience mm-hmm. in their eyes about their lifestyle, but not individually, but have three or four different points of view from different parts of the world on a key issue. Yeah. So that was what was in my mind.
Right.
Now, wasn't that coherent. It developed that way.
Now, you have, at least you mentioned, you were Asia correspondent for the Globe. You had many, many stories. And I was tickled at some of the rules you break, right, as a journalist to get a story. And I think, oh, boy, like the incident on the train and some of the others where you're with the two military guys and you get through, like, stuff that would never happen now, right?
I know.
I thought, wow, what a time to have been a journalist.
You're right. Good for you. And, yes, I did break a lot of rules, but I got away with it.
Yeah.
And I got some great stories. I don't even know it's all in the book, but Kissinger was one of my professors at Harvard. I knew him pretty well.
That is in the book.
Is it in the book about the geisha house?
Yes.
Okay, that was in the book. And then later I was back in the Globe. I really got in trouble with Kissinger again.
Yeah, so now you got to tell the story. You got to tell the story because it's in the book.
Yeah, about the geisha house. And probably not in the book. I got into a base in southern Taiwan when I was out of the Navy as a correspondent, and it happened to be the first parvey by B-52s over North Vietnam, and I was in the brief room when the pilots came back. I wasn't supposed to be there.
Yeah, that's in the book.
Oh, it is in the book.
Yeah,
good.
It's in the book.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what happened?
So I'm saying, sneaking into these places. I got thrown out in
2 days, but no, it isn't good.
You wouldn't get into that briefing room today.
I know. That's quite true.
Yeah. And then you also, as you touched on the World Paper, you ran in 1978, you founded the World Paper. It ran until just before 9/11 in 2001. Tell us about that. Tell us about launching that paper. That was that to give that perspective from different points of view. Was that the idea?
Yes, but it wasn't that coherent right in the beginning. It's like anything else. You go step by step and make it happen. It develops, if it does develop, and evolve in different ways you expect. But I will go backward because I was doing pretty well at the Globe at that point at a young age. I'd been the youngest managing editor and national and foreign editor. And I was approached about this and started thinking about it in the Middle East when I approached the Globe and the publisher and the editor, whom I knew well, and said, I want to give a shot at this. I'd like to have a year off. So if it doesn't work, I can come back. And they were smart enough at the time. They really bummed me out momentarily because I thought it was pretty hot stuff. And they said, look, Crocker, we're not going to give you a year off. If this doesn't work, sure, you'll probably have an opportunity here. But it's not going to worth it if you have this in the back of your mind. You just got to do it. Don't think you're going to keep writing a column for us and all that. Just do it. They were right. I was bummed out. But looking back, they were exactly right because I never looked back. And we started with very small money, as you read in there. And step by step, we got more editors and jobs and developed from being a quarterly to a bi-monthly to a monthly, and kept finding new things. It was difficult to be, we were for profit, because one of the original some of your listeners may know the name of Jim Rouse, the Rouse Company and Faneuil Hall and all that. Well, he was one of the original supporters. And we were talking in the beginning. A lot of them were entrepreneurs that were supporting me, basically. I didn't really know it, but that's true. They'd seen my writing, and they didn't know journalism, but it looked like a great concept, and this guy may be a winner or maybe not. I don't know what they said to each other. Mm-hmm. But we thought in the beginning that because of the concept, we could probably get a couple of $1 million from the Ford Foundation or Rockefeller or something. And I think we probably could have. But Jim Rouse, I remember the meeting, and he said, look, we all know this is a great idea, but it's not a really good idea unless it can make money. I don't want to get money from Ford Foundation or any. And again, I was bummed out, but he was right. Mm-hmm. He just was right. And so we had to keep, we were only profitable of our number of years that we were, 20 some years, we were only profitable probably 3.5 of those years. Mm. But each year we had to raise more money, and we were. We started with investors from 14 different countries. We didn't want American investors because the credibility of the thing being truly international wouldn't be. Right. So we had investors from Malaysia and the Middle East and Venezuela, and they didn't try to influence me remotely. Mm. They just thought it was a good idea, and they saw it and think, well, let's go with it.
Yeah. We're talking with Crocker Snow about his memoir, Swamp Yankee. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Crocker Snow about his memoir, Swamp Yankee. All right, Muskegon, it's a special place, and you wrote a whole book about it, so yes. We'll just touch on it here. But for those who haven't heard or experienced, give us a snapshot of what it's like there.
It's wild. And it's halfway between the big engines that could be in the summer, particularly Nantucket, 10 miles to the east, and Martha's Vineyard, 11 miles, and Chappaquiddick to the west, with all kinds of activity, as you well know, and there's no activity halfway in the middle. It's hard to get there. And yes, technically, me and my family kind of own it, but we don't think that way. We think that nature owns it, mm-hmm. and we're just stewards of nature there and keep it as wild as it can, as it was when my father first got it. There's no electricity, no running water. And I was there. It just so happens I was there last weekend with my dog alone. And at my age, I probably shouldn't be there on my own too much. But I was. And just smart enough not to get in trouble.
Yeah. A lot of memories you have from your childhood.
Oh, unbelievable.
I mean, since you were a child, right?
Unbelievable memories. Yeah. And the other way for a listener to think about it, give or take 250 acres. There's not a tree on it. A lot of poison ivy, a lot of beech grass. And mainly you've heard that it is the sort of center of the gray seal explosion. Then right. They were thought to be extinct. The first one came back in Muskegon, and now in February, there are more than 10,000 on the island. Yeah.
So there's a lot of scientific research that goes on there.
And,
the seals, certainly, that was very key in trying to determine the population, right? I mean, there's a lot that goes on there.
Yes, but I will make the point that scientists are not always right. Because early on when they started coming, there were first maybe 10 or 12, and then maybe 20. They were very colorful, and each one had a name. There's Harold, there's Ruth. And one of the seal scientists, not from NOAA at this time, I remember where she was from, and I said, what's going on here? Because they'd gone up to 200. And I remember her distinctly saying, they'll never hit more than 1,000. They're going to have disease, and they're not going to make it. Well, they were just dead wrong. Well,
isn't that the thing with science? You answer one question, it raises three more. So, yeah, exactly. Yep. One of the things, the wildlife, amazing for birders. You write, it's a birder's paradise, too, with 20 to 25 species found on the average annual bird count.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful place to look at birds, especially seabirds, right?
Yes. It's changing like everything in nature, but it's changing now because vineyard wind. Because you certainly know about that, and that's on the horizon. We never could see anything at night on the horizon under stars, but the 9 or 11 that are halfway 14 miles out, I was there last week, and you get up at midnight and you can see all the navigation lights from them. Supposedly, they had agreed not to have them on except to plane would get nearby. Well, they're not sticking with that because they're on all night.
And I switch to some of your hobbies and things that you're interested in. We don't have much of a chance to see polo games here on the Cape, but that is a sport you very much enjoyed playing, and you have a whole chapter on polo. I also happen to love to. I tried playing polo once. Not a great polo player, but it is very fun to watch.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I played hockey at college, and polo is a very dangerous, fast sport, and it's the added element of being horses and have to coordinate with a horse and not one horse. In a game, you might run five or six or seven different horses, so you have to be very versatile. I got hooked on it with my older brother who was in the Air Force, and I'd been riding all my life and didn't like it because my mother liked me to go to horse shows. And then I got stuck on it, and my family's been pretty involved. Three of my five sons were professional at a high level. And
where do they play?
Oh, they put biggest polo is in Florida in the winter, in the UK, in the West Coast. And there's polo now in 65 countries.
Yeah.
And listeners may be surprised. They may think it's all Prince Charles and Ralph Lauren.
No. Yeah,
it's the way it's marketed, and it really irritates me because it's a tough sport. You can't play unless you're really working hard in dungarees with your horses, and you've got to work, like, and to be good at anything, you really have to work to be good.
Yeah. I'll tell you
where the image is just plain
I'll
wrong.
I'll tell you, I can beat that image because I learned where I was watching it was when I lived in Vermont.
Okay.
Right? So, and it's on this little field.
Yeah,
and
I know.
And the guy, I'm sure he's probably long dead now because it was quite
Andy
a while ago.
Reeds.
He used to play the Philip Sousa marches between. it was hysterical. Yeah. So
I remember
it was
the
a
guy.
Lot of fun.
He used to have, some planes up there, Andy Teeds, and he flew down to my father's place.
Yeah, and it was
he's
just,
long gone. But
local guys there, and it was a lot of fun to watch.
You.
Yeah. Now, you also spent time in Alaska where you say everyone has a story and made me think maybe that's your next book.
Well, I have done a book comparing Nantucket and Alaska called Nantaska, the Minnow and the Whale, basically saying there's a lot of even tiny little Nantucket and gigantic, very similar lifestyle. And I did a book about that.
Yeah.
But it came out just during COVID, so it didn't get a lot of exposure.
So talk a little bit about your time in Alaska. What brought you, I mean, was it your uncle that got you interested in Alaska?
Yes, and my father was a great pilot, and he flew up in a single plane up there. And first I was intrigued with the fishing and just outside. But I got very involved in the Exxon Valdez. And my son, my third son, went out of Lewis and Clark and went up there with Knowles. And step by step, I got more hooked on it. And have you been there?
No, I haven't.
Well, you should.
I know, yes, I should.
I mean, everybody there has a story. Because if they move there, they want to figure out how to stay there, and they have to be very entrepreneurial to do it.
Yeah.
And, no, I at one point, I think if I ever, I live north of Boston, but if I had to move, where would I move to? And I thought Alaska or Japan, one or the other. Very different.
Yeah.
Even though in the old days, Alaska was halfway to Japan because you had to stop in Anchorage. Now you just go over it. But I don't know how to describe it. If you know Montana or Wyoming, I don't want to be too cute about it, but that's kind of kindergarten compared to Alaska, the mountains and everything. It's just so mammoth.
So I don't know anybody who's been to Alaska who hasn't come back and said how gorgeous it is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very beautiful country.
It is, and it's more than that, too. The people are, as I said, they all have a story, and they're not fake stories. They've all been out there, and they've all made it happen one way or another.
Yeah. Having lived and worked around the world, you have an interesting perspective and understanding of the impacts of climate change in particular, which you say is the most significant development in your lifetime. Talk a little bit about that, because obviously this didn't hit you when you were in these areas, as in the Navy and as a journalist, right? So is this looking back, your perspective? When did climate change and the impacts come on your radar?
Wow. That's tough. Slowly.
Yeah, some say slowly, right?
I mean, slowly with Rachel Carson, which I mentioned, whose statue is right down here. But in reality, I think the reality was when I was at the Boston Globe the first Earth Day. Mm-hmm. And Tom Winship was the editor at the time, and he knew I was kind of wide awake. And he had me and another guy came, Jim Eyre. I don't know what this Earth Day is all about. Go cover it. And I think that got me going. I also have a relationship with John Kerry, and he was involved in the second Earth Day down, and step by step that way. But I've been extremely lucky, fortunate, because Muskeget, going there all the time without even knowing it, I was experiencing it every 2 months. This had changed and this had changed. And being in Alaska and Prince William Sound, I just kind of experienced things without knowing it until I realized it. Mm. Well, I don't know. I don't want to get so philosophical about it. I should say one amazing thing that might be appropriate. I'm very lucky to have pets and dogs and horses in my life because I oversee the Harvard Polo Team. Mm. And if you listen to animals, I don't mean I'm a horse whisperer. I'm not. Mm-hmm. But animals tell you a lot.
Yeah.
And dogs do.
We don't give them credit enough for their intelligence.
No, my dog's right in the car. And she drove up to me. And one time I drove all the way just with my dog, 1,200 miles. And we got in trouble. But the dog knew when we were getting in trouble. Get out of here, Dad.
Let's go, yeah.
And horses are the same way.
Yeah.
And if you're open to their way of communicating.
I'm going to say you actually end the book with this haiku-like thing. I'm just going to read it. It says, climate is changing before our eyes, lighter than air, one hand clapping. There's no silver bullet. There's no panacea. It's best to pay attention.
And it's not a real haiku. It's one too many lines,
but haiku-like.
Deliberately.
Haiku-like.
Yes, exactly. That's good for you. Thank you.
Yeah. Before we go, I wanted to ask you, you had such an amazing career as a journalist, and you talk so much about it in the book. Is there one, story or one experience that you just relive in your mind sometimes as, the best?
Yes.
What is it?
I was involved with the Pentagon Papers, and I knew Kissinger and I knew Dan Ellsberg. And the listeners who remember when Ellsberg was pro-war and then against war, and then eventually approached the New York Times with it secret, and the Times got shut down, and then the Washington Post. I knew it was coming our way, the Globe. And Tom Oliphant and I, we picked it up from him in a telegram place in Cambridge, just cardboard boxes with the Pentagon Papers. No, the feds were around. No, we would have one day to get it out, the new information. We put out a fake issue of the Globe, the first issue, so the feds wouldn't know what was happening. Then we put it all out in the other editions of the Globe. And I was in charge of our team very quickly because I'd been at the Fletcher School and I'd been in Vietnam, blah, blah, blah. And Tom Winship was a very well-known editor at the time. And about 3 a.m, we got it out and he looked around and he said, "Snow, get rid of these." And we put them all in, I don't want to exaggerate, 3 or 4 cardboard boxes.
So what are you going to do with this?
Well,
right?
And I put them in my car outside in the boot. And he said, "Just get rid of these things. The feds are going to be here in the morning," which was true. "And don't tell me where you take them." And I started driving out of the Globe on Morris Avenue at the time. And I head for Logan Airport because my father had worked there. And my thought was, left luggage places in Logan Airport. So I just drove up at 4 a.m. and drove in with 4 cards and found a left luggage thing. There aren't very many airports any longer, but they used to be everywhere. And I put them into that, took the key, and drove away. Went back to the Globe. The Fed showed up. Tom was there, and I was there and others, Marty Nolan, whose bylines had already appeared, and they talked to Tom.
He said, was, I don't know where they
the
are.
The feds did. Where are the Pentagon Papers? And no idea. And he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, they didn't ask me. They saw my byline, and they said, why'd you do that? And I said, well, it's the most important that hadn't been published. It was about the CIA on the front page. But they never asked me. And had they asked me, I'm not sure what I would have said.
Yeah. And then
so
after,
nobody found it for 3 months.
Right. And then they told you, okay, go get those papers when it all kind of calmed
down. About 3 months later.
Yeah. And you did.
And I did.
And who knows what happened to them?
You mean after that?
Yeah.
They went to the Bank of Boston vaults.
Right.
I took them. By then, we were open about it. No, we weren't open about it.
Yeah.
But Tom, by then, and the editors of the Boston, I mean, the legal people, Hill and Bauer, were the lawyers for the Boston Globe, said, I think we're clear. Get them to the Bank of Boston vault.
And they could still be there for
they
all
could
you know.
Be. No, they're out in my car.
The book is Swamp Yankee Adventures, Chronicle of a Journalist in Low Orbit Around the World. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Cracker Snow, thanks for being here and talking about it. It was a fun read.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Yeah, you're a bit head for Alaska.
I'll do it.
Okay, great. Nice to see you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.